Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Right, thanks for coming along tonight to hear John Robertson make his first appearance at the Sydney Institute. He's well known, so I will introduce John Robertson briefly. Among other career highlights, he was Secretary of Unions New South Wales. He then joined the Upper House as an MLC from 2008 to 2011, became the MP for Blacktown in 2011, and of course leader of the Labour opposition in 2011. Mr. Robertson also held ministerial positions in the Labour government before the current government. So John Robertson is very welcome here tonight, and his topic is connecting Labour back to people. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Jared. Can I firstly just begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land that we're gathered on and pay my respects to elders both past and present and say how much I appreciate the opportunity to address the Sydney Institute. This is an institute that has a wonderful reputation as a centre for thoughtful discussion, dialogue and debate. In that context, I don't expect to necessarily change your mind or your views, but rather to share a little about my background, how this shapes my approach to politics and the future of the Labor Party 1 year out from the next state election in March next year. I've worked at senior levels of government and seen how good policy and even controversial policy can succeed when it has a passionate advocate behind it. And like many people in public life, I've been willing to change my mind and I've been open to new ideas. However, even after more than a decade on the political front lines, my approach to politics has and will continue to be heavily influenced by my experiences in life, working as an electrician and a union organiser, leading the Your Rights at Work campaign as Secretary of Unions New South Wales, and serving as a government minister in portfolios as varied as energy, environment, corrective services and transport. After I finished school, I spent almost 8 years working as an electrician, working early mornings on construction sites right across Sydney. For me, a Western Sydney family life is not an academic focus group soundbite. It's the life my family and I have lived. The reason I'm in politics is because I care about and want to fight for everyday workers and their families. I moved from the shop floor to take on a role as a union organiser, and for 20 years I worked in the union movement representing people from right across the state and all walks of life. While the popular view of a union official is backroom lunches and power politics, the reality for me was very different. My time as a unionist was spent largely at workplace meetings, speaking to workers about the issues that were affecting them. It was my duty to stand up for them and to be their voice. I saw the decisions that governments and employers were making through the eyes of everyday workers who were impacted by those decisions. I saw firms shut down, leaving hundreds of workers without jobs, worried sick about how they're going to bring home a wage and provide for their family. When a job site closed, I knew the names of the workers who were losing their jobs. I spoke to the families of injured workers. I can tell you from experience, anyone who's seen a mate injured at work would tell you, a little bit of red tape is more than justified if it can save someone from losing a limb or worse still, losing their life. These experiences, as an electrician and as a unionist, are an important influence on how I view the world and my approach to government. When I look at a policy or a piece of legislation. I want to know how this is going to affect people on the ground, their families and their livelihood. After the last election, we needed to re-engage with the true principles of Labor. I believed then, and I still believe now, that Labor is the only true agent for change that improves the lives of all communities. In my lifetime, Australian Labor has shattered the long-held myth of economic growth. That myth was that we needed to make a choice between prosperity or fairness. The reforms of the Hawke-Keating era remodelled Australian economic competitiveness and brought every Australian with them. Tony Blair looked to the Australian model and called it the third way. For Australian Labor, it has always been the only way. It was never a choice between what was prosperous or fair. The choice was always to serve both. Labor floated the dollar and created Medicare. Labor reformed our financial system and made university affordable through HECS. Labor created superannuation and protected our environment. Labor does not ask communities to choose between opportunity and security. These things are not mutually exclusive, they are mutually supportive. In many ways, this shapes the way I see some of the key challenges facing New South Wales, such as rising unemployment, the housing affordability crisis, and the collapse of trust in government. The unemployment rate has steadily been rising in New South Wales, from 5% in March 2011 to 5.8% in February this year. But these are just statistics. In reality, this means more than 37,000 extra people are out of work. That's 37,000 additional families who are finding it harder to make ends meet. Even for those that are still employed, they're feeling less secure in their jobs and they're worried about the future as we see more and more major employers and industries downsizing or closing down. For me, there's nothing more heartbreaking than seeing workers who are unable to find work and, more importantly, unable to provide for their family. In 2011, I proposed funding for reskilling workers and capital investment to support new industries in regional areas, to help deal with the long-term structural changes due to the winding down of the resources boom and the high Australian dollar. In 2012, I called for the government to set up a jobs commission with independent industry experts to prepare a jobs plan for New South Wales, identifying future industries and employment opportunities, skill shortages and opportunities to relocate public sector jobs to regional areas. We've continued to call for a jobs plan as the number of people unemployed in New South Wales continues to grow. Labor has also offered bipartisan support for a second airport at Badgerys Creek. And while it might not be politically popular or easy, especially in my own seat of Blacktown, I strongly believe it is in the best interests of Western Sydney and the state. This is a project with the potential to be the basis of a state and federal partnership to deliver major infrastructure upgrades, a catalyst to transform Western Sydney and unlock the potential for thousands of new jobs. Unfortunately, the government has refused to take action on these policies or provide assistance to workers. Instead, its solution has been to hand out payroll tax subsidies for business through a scheme which even the New South Wales Business Chamber says, and I quote, is ineffective and is not providing employers with any significant incentive to take on additional staff. And I end the quote there. At the same time, the government is cutting back on vocational education, cutting 800 staff, including teachers, from TAFE, reducing the number of courses offered at TAFE campuses, and increasing TAFE fees by 10%, with plans for them to more than double. I believe this is exactly the wrong approach, handing out millions of dollars to businesses through a scheme which isn't working and cutting back on skills training that increases productivity and makes workers more employable. the disconnect between a decision taken in Macquarie Street and how it impacts on everyday people can also be seen looking at the growing housing affordability crisis. While I agree that the government has rightfully identified the shortage of supply as a major challenge to housing affordability, and this is an area that needs to be addressed, their policies have completely missed the mark. The government has lost touch with the impact on families, claiming success on the back of rising housing approvals, while the number of first home buyers has hit the lowest levels in 20 years. And the government's decision to scrap first home buyers grants and stamp duty concessions for existing homes, which is how most people enter the property market, has put the great Australian dream beyond the reach now for so many young families. While I understand there is an argument against housing subsidies, the government is now handing over taxpayer grants to property investors, including those from overseas, to buy new dwellings. Giving grants to everybody in the market, first home buyers, upgraders and property investors to buy new dwellings, is simply driving prices up, which we've seen skyrocket by 10% just last year. This isn't helping with supply, it's just adding to demand and handing over taxpayer funds to developers. These are just two examples in key areas of how the government's policies and how they are measuring policy success are at odds with the impact on people in the community. This disconnect is the last thing we need at a time when trust in government and politics is sadly at an all-time low. The scandals and the leadership instability of the recent years have left their mark on the public. More than ever, everyone in politics needs to be working to rebuild faith in our system of government. I acknowledge how damaging the last term of the previous government was to public confidence, and how hard we need to work to rebuild trust. Labor is committed to this. I'm committed to this. And that's why I've announced our new standard policy, which outlines major reforms to increase transparency and accountability, making sure our elected officials are putting the community first. Under the new standard policy, MPs will be banned from secondary employment and required to publicly report their income and their assets, including those held by their spouse or dependent children. We will create an Inspector General for Parliamentary Standards to investigate and penalise MPs who breach the Code of Conduct. Mining licences will be reviewed by an independent probity panel and require full Cabinet approval. The Premier and Ministers will be forced to publish a diary of all contact with lobbyists, companies and MPs regarding commercial transactions and decisions. And greater protection will be provided to whistleblowers who come forward and report corruption. To date, the Premier has refused to implement these policies and instead has decided to play politics on government reform. He's even scrapped his own election commitment to remove application fees for Freedom of Information requests. Our state needs a shared commitment to undertake changes required to stamp out corruption and restore public faith in government. This should be something that unites all political parties, not something that divides us. How we approach these challenges will be crucial for the state's future prosperity. But as we look closer at our society, there are a growing number of people who are disconnected from this agenda. People who, for some reason, simple or otherwise, are just simply missing out. People confronting homelessness, alcohol and drug abuse, violence in the home, child neglect, and a growing mental health crisis. In many ways, these are much more difficult issues. I believe that these are vulnerable Australians that we cannot ignore. And only a government that is compassionate and focused on people, with a core belief that it is our duty to speak for those who do not have a voice, has a chance to actually tackle these issues. I have little doubt that with I have little doubt that with wall-to-wall Liberal governments across Australia, we are about to see what I would describe as an aggressive Conservative agenda take hold in this country. But this creates an opportunity for Labor at a state and national level to clearly demonstrate how we are different. This is a chance for Labor to publicly reaffirm our founding belief in a more humane and caring vision of government, committed to the simple idea that government exists to help everyday families, rather than being solely focused on the economic bottom line. This fits with how Labor has traditionally been seen by the electorate, as the compassionate party, a party that genuinely cares about the fate of everyday working families. Over the years, people have said Labor might not always get it right, but at least Labor cares. This is exactly why the actions of a couple of bad eggs in the previous state Labor government were so devastating electorally. It shattered the public's view of Labor as caring about them by putting a question mark over whose interests were being put first. The truth is, the vast majority of Labor MPs are good, honest people who have entered public life because they want to help their community. Our future as a political party will depend on our ability to demonstrate this to the community. We must show that Labor has changed for the better and is once again the party that cares, by keeping our focus on the issues that matter to everyday families, standing up for the community, and most importantly, reforming our party. That's why I support the selection of Labor candidates involving the broader community with a trial of community pre-selections, or primaries, in 5 seats. I'm also committed to implementing direct election of the New South Wales parliamentary leader, taking the process out of the back rooms and giving MPs and party members an equal say, similar to the model that was used to select the federal leader, Bill Shorten. Now, there are some within the party who are advocating for trade unions to be part of the direct election process, and that the vote should be split 3 ways between MPs, party members, and affiliated unions. Now, while I'm a passionate supporter of unions and very proud of my time as a union official, I don't believe this is the right model. We need to be giving party members a bigger say if we want to modernise our party and re-energise our grassroots membership, both of which are essential to a party which prides itself on its connections with the community. It's for this reason that I'm going to put my full weight behind changes to party rules needed to implement a 50-50 direct election model at the 2014 annual conference. Ladies and gentlemen, these are changes that must be made if Labor is to have a future. I believe there is a fundamental difference between the Labor Party and the Coalition. We believe the role for government is to make people's lives a little bit easier and a little bit better, while I think the Coalition believes government should simply get out of the way. The Coalition's political ascendancy gives Labor an opportunity to reaffirm our core belief in putting people at the centre of policy and government decision making. I believe that by being committed to change, to modernising and opening up the Labor Party, to increasing transparency and accountability in government, and reaffirming our core belief in putting people at the centre of everything we do, Labor can once again be the party that everyday families turn to. I regard this as my critical mission in leading a party and a government that cares about the people of New South Wales. Thank you.
Many thanks to John Robertson. So we've come to questions and discussion, and we've got plenty of time. So I'll just start off. Thanks for your address. You made the point on a couple of occasions that Labor cares, and I think people would agree with that. But the question is, what does that mean? If you look at, you also mentioned unemployment, and as you know, in parts of Sydney and New South Wales, youth unemployment is outrageously high. And unemployment is a lag indicator, and the federal Labor government's got to have some responsibility for that. Now, if you're going to get a job in Western Sydney, you're probably going to get it with a small business person. The current unfair dismissal laws are a real disincentive to employing a young person. The penalty rates on Sundays are a disincentive to opening up a business on that day. What about moving away from the concept of caring to how you might encourage small business to take the risk of employing someone who might be young, who might be a migrant, who may not be all that well educated?
One of the things I'm very conscious of is the fact that about 80% of people are employed by small to medium enterprises, and I feel, I've spent 3 years moving around, that we all have to do better when it comes to providing incentives for people to effectively invest their own time, their money, to grow a business and provide employment opportunities. I have never been someone that's convinced that the unfair dismissal laws of themselves are the great bogey that people talk about. I do accept that I think with unfair dismissal laws there needs to be a better explanation for how they work and how they can be implemented and how they be applied. But I don't believe that they of themselves are the barrier that people talk about. I think what we've got to be doing more of is actually looking and engaging with small business about how do we make life easier for them in the same way that we do with others. On the issue of penalty rates, you might be unsurprised to hear me say that I'm not convinced that penalty rates on Sundays is something we should abolish. And I say that for a couple of reasons. I heard someone say that we are now a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week society, that we want to consume 7 days a week. And to a certain extent, that is true. But if you look at what most families do and most family activities and most family gatherings, they occur on Saturday or Sunday. Most family sport occurs for young kids on Saturdays and Sundays. And as someone said recently, when the grand final is played on a weekday, I will believe that we no longer have weekends. And I would say the same thing about Parliament and other places, that when the Parliament's sitting on Saturdays and Sundays, I'll be convinced then that we are truly a 7-day-a-week economy. But fundamentally, people still do program their lives around Saturdays and Sundays. I do it even though I work Saturdays and Sundays these days, Jared. It's still that notion that people do get together on weekends. And I do think that we do need to be conscious of the history associated with those sorts of things. But there is no doubt in my mind, and one of the things that I'm very conscious of, is that we have got to do better than we currently do when it comes to providing incentives for small business, particularly because, as I say, I'm very much aware. My wife ran a small business for a period of time, so I know firsthand the difficulties and the struggles of running a small business, despite the fact that I'm regularly yelled at across the chamber that you wouldn't know what it's like to run a small business. I think we do need to be conscious of those things, but I'm not sure we need to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Now, we'll take a question here. Don't stand in front of the camera later on. Jacqueline, yeah.
Thank you for your address. I just wanted to ask you about the provision that you're going to introduce with regard to no second jobs. I'm not sure that would actually court Mr. Obeid anyway, because I don't think he was actually employed officially outside the Parliament. But there's one argument that I think has some merit, that is that some of the people that do have second jobs, people that work in communities, the doctors and that, it actually keeps them in touch. We hear that politicians are often out of touch, and surely those that can, particularly in opposition, have some time in the workforce, it's actually a good way of bringing us, we the community, back in.
Well, I agree, and I should just say our Shadow Minister for Health is sitting at the back of the room, someone who is still practising as a physician. And I have made it very clear that if people, and the good doctor himself actually does pro bono work on a regular basis, and I have no issues with that. We have lawyers who I've told the same thing, that if they want to do pro bono work, they should feel free to do that. I volunteer my time at places like Food Bank. Whether you would describe that as a second job or not, I'm not sure, but I've volunteered with Habitat for Humanity, who build houses at various times, and I was involved in a build in Western Sydney, using my old skills as an electrician. There are no issues with that, and that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about where there's paid employment, where there is a potential conflict. My view with our jobs and our responsibilities as MPs is it's a full-time occupation. But I would expect that MPs would be volunteering their time within their communities to stay in touch with those community groups, those community organisations, And Dr. McDonald volunteers at an Aboriginal health service for young children as a paediatrician for just that reason. So I'm talking about paid employment, where you might have a conflict and suddenly decide that, that there is a conflict between the second job that you've got and your role as an MP. I'm trying to ensure that's not the case. In regards to the people that you talked about and the second employment wouldn't have captured those, that's quite true. But the other things that I've talked about would potentially capture them. So things like the pecuniary interest declarations, where you're required to declare your taxable income, any interest that you have, but also any interest that you, your spouse or dependent children have, would also be required to be declared. Now, my front bench do that now. I haven't waited for the government to implement that. My pecuniary interest declaration, if you're feeling sleepy or can't sleep tonight, just Google it. You can have a look at it. It's not very exciting, but it's there right now. That's the first step in dealing with it. The second part is by putting an Inspector General for Parliamentary Standards in place that is a full-time job, that is actually investigating pecuniary interest declarations. When questions are raised, that person will be responsible for calling MPs in and asking them questions, have the capacity to find them, and if serious breaches occur, actually recommend to the Parliament that they be removed from the Parliament for breaching the code of conduct. Some people have said they're very onerous obligations. They are. But I think we've got to do better in giving people real confidence that politicians are there for the right reasons, that there are no conflicts of interest. There are some MPs that sit in Macquarie Street who claim to own nothing, not even their own home. People who've been in the Parliament for 16 years who claim they own nothing. I just don't even believe that passes the believability test for most people, that someone sitting in Macquarie Street for 16 years doesn't own anything. Clearly it's all in someone else's name. All that should be on the public record. And I say to people who go, oh, it's onerous and it's an unreasonable invasion of privacy, if you don't like it, don't get into politics.
So there's a question here. Yeah.
It's obvious that at the last state election, Labor's problem was it lost the West. And as you talk very much as a union-inspired Labor person from the West. Why do you think you lost the West? Apart from caring, because I think it's bigger than caring.
Look, there's no doubt it is bigger than caring. I think that what we've seen play out at ICAC had a huge, played a huge role in that. The leadership changes played a massive role in that. I think a lot of people looked... People who had historically, you know, was described as our heartland, people who had historically looked to Labor to be their voice, we were very much viewed as focused on ourselves and not focused on the things that were important to people in the West. I think that was a huge contributing factor to why so many people walked away. Why I take this job so seriously is that, for a number of reasons, but I remember on election day standing at one of the schools in Blacktown, and this man came out and he finished voting and he came up to me and he goes, you better not let me down because I voted for you. Now my take on that was, he was somebody who was seriously contemplating not voting Labor but couldn't bring himself to do that. So I take my responsibility to those sorts of people very seriously for us to get our act together. But it fundamentally, I think, went to the whole point of too many leadership changes, too focused on ourselves, too much internal brawling and talking about ourselves. And in doing so, just losing sight of the fact of why we're really there, why those people have historically voted for us. I think there is a demographic change in the West as well. I was going to come to that. And I think part of that also contributes to the change in attitude that you see in the West towards things like a second airport in Western Sydney. I think as I move around the West, there's no doubt. I mean, I've grown up, spent my whole life in various parts of Western Sydney and seen it change. The demographics are changing. You've got a lot of people that I've worked with who I know who are tradies now out on their own living in Western Sydney who bring a different perspective to the table. There's a whole series of things, and it's why I go back to that earlier point about why we've got to connect with those small business people.
There's a question here.
Just in answer to Anne's question before I asked mine, they've become all aspirational. The Western suburbs is doing exactly what our society wants. They've all become aspirational. They're not working type. They're aspirational. They want to make money. They want to move up into the next level of class. And this leads me into my question. And I'm hoping that you actually saw Alan Kohler's graph the night before last.
No, I'm sorry, I didn't.
No, it's a shame.
No, I didn't see it either. So let's get to the point. So
the point is, Alan Kohler's graph showed the income earned from people from 1963 to 2011. And the graph showed that the CEOs, the professional, the business, the middle class, the line of the graph from the axis goes this way, and the working class graph was from the axes straight along the flat line. Anyone can go and get it on.
I want to know
why that is the case. All the incomes have increased dramatically.
Okay, we got it.
The working class income has not increased.
Well, I'm not sure I can give you the answer, but what we have seen is CEOs and senior managers now moving globally, something that didn't occur in the 60s and 70s, where we're seeing the CEOs being brought in from overseas to run those companies. I mean, Qantas was just an obvious example with Alan Joyce, but there are so many that come. And the argument would be for CEO salaries that, well, you're in a global market, you've got to compete on those global scales. I think there is a real challenge for us in terms of this real sense of a growing inequity between the well-paid and the not-so-well-paid. I mean, in my electorate of Blacktown, I can see it. It's there. It is something that we need to do. But the best way to do it is by creating more jobs, creating more well-paid jobs, and starting to look at where those opportunities are for the jobs of the future that are going to give young people the sorts of jobs that pay well in those cutting-edge areas that are growing and that are emerging.
Go down the back and then we come up to Stuart. Yep.
One of the things that's slightly concerning about what you're saying or what Mr. O'Farrell is saying is that actually the world has changed. Last night I was with a couple called Kevin and Julia Hartz. I don't know if anybody even knows who they are in this room. They're two young Silicon Valley entrepreneurs who actually in January became the latest under 40 billionaires. They're in Australia because Australia is 4% of their market. And they're opening an office here. That is the world now, and that's where young people are employed. But politicians don't seem to understand that what we'd like to do is have a reason to vote for people instead of hearing about all the things that have gone wrong or more of the old jobs. I mean, there's always new things coming through.
Okay, so the suggestion is that the world's changed and politicians haven't.
But no,
okay, we've got it.
Same needs to go into the western suburbs. A new way of working. Politicians need to...
Okay, the suggestion is there should be... I've got to put this for the podcast. There should be business hubs created in western Sydney. Right.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I think my experience of 51 years living there is the west has missed out for a whole range of reasons. It's why I'm so passionately backing a second airport, because I think it's the catalyst that actually changes the way people look at Western Sydney. My view of Western Sydney is there will be a million people choose to live there in the next 20 years, and there will be a jobs deficit of about 300,000, if you believe what the experts are telling us at the moment. That's why we need something like an airport that actually transforms that. I don't take the view that I know what the jobs will be in 10 years' time. I mean, if you look back 10 years, you couldn't have imagined the jobs that are in place now, and I don't think politicians should be telling and picking winners when it comes to industries and those sorts of things. I see politicians as facilitators to make those things a reality, and there are certain things that politicians can do, like an airport and those sorts of things, that will be a catalyst for people to come here and actually invest in those areas for those sorts of jobs, because it's close, it's easy to get in and out of, and it attracts those global...
Okay, I think we can't pick all these things up. Right, there's a question here.
Yeah, look, within the framework that the public sector is the biggest employer in New South Wales, what would your approach be to industrial relations in the public service? And also, what do you see as the future of the Industrial Relations Commission of New South Wales?
Well, I think the Industrial Relations Commission of New South Wales is all but defunct. It still has a president in Michael Walton. But by and large, its whole focus is really within the public. It just deals with the public sector, and only a very small part of that. I mean, if you look at areas like public transport, they're all dealt with now by the Fair Work Commission and those sorts of things. There's no doubt that we need to do better in our public service, but I think this notion that our public service is just people who sit at office desks and, you know, push paper around and count paperclips is not really the way to look at it. There are a lot of people there that do things, and I'll just give you one example in health. There's a part within health that deals with issues associated with outbreaks of particular diseases, and then makes decisions about where resources are allocated throughout the time. So if you end up with a H1N1 situation or some sort of flu virus, where those outbreaks occur, you have people there that are actually doing things to make sure that services are provided where they are needed most. I think, again, we should always be looking to improve the way our public sector works. But I do worry that there has been this push to just push people out the door under the guise of, well, they wear cardigans, they count paper clips and they push paper around. Health's a good example where that's not the case. Education's another example where you had what I believe was an important part in the Department of Education that dealt with English as second language, where you had a coordinating body within the Department of Education that was allocating ESL services to kids that were turning up at schools who'd grown up and been looked after by grandparents who had no English, so they turn up with no English capacity at all, or they arrive here and their English is very limited. We've now got a situation where that part of the department has completely disappeared for this great push of, you know, we've got to cut costs and push these people out the door because they're, you know, cardigan-wearing public servants. I think that's not always the case, and I think we've just got to be very careful about how we go and the approach we take when it comes to public sector reform. But that said, I don't believe you can just leave things as they are either.
Question here.
Vocational education and training is very important. You mentioned the present government is cutting something like 800 jobs from the department or from TAFE. But these resources cut back in TAFE started way back in the Labor government, and particularly when Minister Aquilina amalgamated TAFE into schools, and schools being more politically sensitive gets all the attention. What would a future Labor government do about funding TAFE, increasing the resources and maybe even giving it its own Director General and getting it away from schools?
Well, I think the first thing I'll be doing is actually putting the funding back into TAFE. I think if you're looking at it, our economy is going through a transition at the moment. There's no risk. If you look at Victoria, if you look at places like Orange and Bathurst, I mean, Orange is about to lose just over 500 jobs with the closure of Electrolux in 2015. Bathurst, you've seen food producer Simplot lay off 120 workers. You've seen Downer EDI close their operations out there. TAFE is absolutely critical when your economy's going through transition to provide people with the opportunities to actually get skills, upgrade their existing skills, or get new skills to go and get another job and another career path. I think the experience for most people that have found themselves in that transition, TAFE's been one of those great safety nets that save people. From where I sit, it's absolutely crucial that that vehicle is there to allow those people to get on with their jobs. Because the reality is, for most people, they just want to get on with getting another job, paying the bills and get on with their life, put the roof over their head, put the food on the table. Government is the facilitator that allows them to do that. And you can do that in a number of ways. You can pay Social Security, or you can provide them with the opportunity to get new skills. I think government's responsibility should be much more focused on properly funding TAFE so those people can get their skills and get another job.
The last time I read your personal correspondence, Paul Keating was having a go at you, as I recall. I think he may have released it rather than you, but he seemed to be suggesting that you'd treated Maurice Yemmer unfairly. So how are you getting on with Mr. Yemmer, and how are you getting on with Mr. Keating?
Well, I think it's fair to say that I've had brief conversations with both of them. They've been polite when they've occurred. But look, my focus is very much on getting on with this job, and I've had other leaders who've been very generous with their time when I became opposition leader, people like Bob Carr and others have been very helpful giving me their time and some guidance. I've been someone who's always been very passionate about what I believe and stood up and said what I think is important and what needs to be said. And sometimes some people don't like that inside the Labor Party and outside the Labor Party. Jared, that's who I am, and if I believe it and I believe it's right, it's something that I will strongly advocate for because I think it's the right thing to do.
Well, I guess, to be fair, you're not the only one who's had a row with Mr. Keating. It's just down the back here, yeah.
I really agree with surprising with a lot of what you said, despite the fact politically I'm very different views. But one thing that I guess that troubles me insurance, etc. I think Sweden has recently got very close to a fascism. And to my mind, education begins with, you cannot have an educated society without good primary education. You can have all the vocational education in the world, it's not going to take you anywhere if people can't do it.
Okay.
And I wondered whether you or other people have, for instance, have engaged in some sort of analysis of why it is some other countries, particularly Scandinavia,
okay, so the tradition is in Scandinavia that they're into decentralisation of education, particularly primary education.
One of the things that I have been looking at, and it's probably one of the very few enjoyable things about opposition, is you get time to think, you get time to go and pick brains of academics, of business leaders and the like, and I've spent the best part of the 3 years doing a lot of that. The experience that I have had when it comes to education has been that everybody talks about Finland as being the model, although I think recently they've sort of slipped from the top peg, they've slipped down a few rungs. I'm certainly someone who thinks that we ought to be making our decisions based on evidence, the best available evidence, whatever that is. So when it comes to education, I don't have a closed mind to some of the approaches that you've talked about. What I want to do is make the best decisions based on the best possible evidence that's available. Looking at the Scandinavian countries, Finland and some of the others, I think is absolutely critical, as well as I think, you know, the British are sort of moving slowly towards a bit of a Finn model as well. I think what we've got to do is try and pick those bits. I'm very much someone who's an adapter rather than an adopter, if that makes sense. I think there are certain things that are unique about a lot of what we do here in Australia. Education is one of those. I think there is a lot that we can adapt from overseas. I always worry when people just sort of almost like pull it off the shelf and go, we'll plug it into this and it will just work. I don't think it's as straightforward as that. But I do agree with you that those early years of education are absolutely critical if we are going to put young people in this nation in the best possible position to get the sorts of jobs you're talking about for the future. That people will come here, they will set up business because we've got well-educated people who can think.
Question here.
You mentioned before that you want to see mining permits issued by independent bodies. I was wondering what mechanism you saw for appointing those bodies, and if it's ultimately just the minister appointing them again, is that going to restore confidence?
I'm saying what we ought to do is there are a whole range of people out there in the private sector who are probity auditors, that you would be selecting them from the private sector and engaging them to conduct probity audits of the process that is followed through. You would have a panel so that you couldn't simply go, oh, let's pick that particular individual because they're sympathetic or whatever the case might be. You would have a panel that would just roll through of people who are probity auditors out there in the private sector doing probity audits on a whole range of other things as well.
There's a question here, then we'll go down there.
So just back to education. So in the market for education services in New South Wales, that's to say the universe of schools that are available to the average family, what is it about the New South Wales public education system which has so demoralised parents that a third of them are prepared to spend tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars on the on private education?
Well, I don't think you could put it down to one thing, but I would say, for instance, and I'll just talk about my experience, say in Blacktown. I go to a lot of the Catholic schools, I meet with the Parents and Federation there, and I, as part of what I've been doing, and I talk to those people and they tell me, you know, they go without holidays, they don't have Foxtel, there's a whole range of things that they do, because I make the point when I listen to Greens and others attacking private education, I say, in my electorate, parents are not wealthy that are sending their children to private schools, they are going without in order to send their son or daughter to one of those schools. I think part of it has been a perception. I think there's some great educators in our public school system as well. I think one of the difficulties for public education is the fact that it ends up with a lot of the students that aren't in the private schools for a whole range of reasons, some of which is simple socioeconomics and some of it's behavioural and a whole range of other things. So that's always a challenge for our public schools. I think we've got some great public schools. I mean, you go to places like James Roos Ag that continue to top, you know, HSC results and the like. I think it's always dangerous to generalise and say public schools don't deliver. A lot of our public schools do very well. I think in those areas where our public schools aren't doing so well, we do need to be providing them with more resources and more capacity to do better. I'll just share one story with you, which is Doonside Technology High, a pretty tough school. Doonside's got a very heavy concentration of an Indigenous population. Blacktown local government area has the highest number of urbanised Indigenous people in the nation. Doonside has a very high concentration of Indigenous people. The principal at Doonside Technology High is a wonderful man, does a great job, but spends more of his time dealing with politics and as a social worker than he is as an educator. Now, for mine, he's a great educator and he's great at doing what he's doing. I think we should be providing him with an additional resource that actually allows him to go back to doing what he's doing and someone else doing the social work and dealing with the problems in the community and those sorts of things. I think we can do better to improve our public education system, but I think part of it is simply resourcing. But Doonside Technology High, from people outside, would go, well, I'm not sending my kids there. But I meet with the staff, you meet with the parents that are actively involved there. These are people who are trying to make their school a little bit better. They just, some of them, with good principles, just need a bit more support and assistance.
Around the corner there. Yep. The suggestion is that in the period of EDOB, people in the Labor government did not speak out about the problem.
I've had this raised with me by a journalist from a mainstream media paper who's pretty much raised that same question. And I made the point to him at that time that there were lots of media stories about what was going on. A number of those media outlets were successfully sued in our court system for defamation on the basis that it couldn't be proved. Now, I put my faith in our legal system. Our legal system allowed him to sue a couple of media outlets for the stories that they were writing, which led me to assume that if the legal system says that you can successfully sue these media outlets, that there was nothing to these stories. And I think that's one of the reasons why that was the case. Hindsight's a wonderful thing, and you know, I've got to say, I'm disgusted as a Labor Party member, not because I'm leader and not because I was there from 2008, but I'm disgusted with people who use and have used the Labor Party to advance their own personal interests. And frankly, what I've done and what I've sought to do internally within the Labor Party is make sure that we never have people like that in the party as parliamentarians in the future. We've put in place a process now that requires anyone who wants to be a candidate for Labor to go through a due diligence process, something which people would say, well, surely that was something that happened. None of the political parties do any of this. So we've set up a panel that's chaired by the former Deputy Premier, John Watkins, that actually requires people to make declarations about a whole range of things. They go through an interview process, that if they don't pass that interview process, they will not be candidates in the future, because I don't want to see that happen again. I expelled these people. I had these people expelled from the Labor Party because I am absolutely disgusted. Now, people will draw their own conclusions on that, but I think there's nothing you can do that is worse than using an organisation, whatever that organisation is, whether it's a business or a political party, for your own personal gain. And that's what these people did. And it shouldn't be lost on anyone. But as I keep saying to people, hindsight's a wonderful thing. And looking back, yes, it would have been great if someone had said something and if something had been done. It didn't. And I can't change that. But what I can do is make sure that it never happens again in the Labor Party that I lead. You know, I had them expelled and I've made it abundantly clear. Anyone else who gets pinged for corruption is out.
Now we're getting close to the end. There's a question. I've got to be brief.
I understand that the proportion of the workforce there were union members, and I was only about 18% downwards on that, 40-odd% a few decades ago. Considering they are such avid supporters of the Labour Party, does this not cause you some concern? In which case, what can you really plan to do about it?
The suggestion is that workforce, the unionisation of the workforce is down to 18%, but they still have a significant influence on the Labour Party.
They do, and I think that unions, regardless of how many members they have, still have a significant influence on what happens in workplaces generally, whether they're fully unionised or not. For mine, there are a couple of things. Firstly, I think there is a place for them within the Labour Party. I don't think it's around the issues of leadership selection and those sorts of things, which I've talked about. But I do think that there is still a role there for unions. This will always be an ongoing debate within the Labour Party. And one of the great things that I do like and I encourage within the Labour Party is debate. I think Labor's always been strongest when it's been prepared to debate issues, when we haven't shut people down from putting those arguments forward in the party forums and the like. And I actually encourage more debate, not less, because I think the more you debate issues, the better and the stronger the position is that you will arrive at, because what you say and the position that you take will have been well and truly tested by people who have an alternate view. I don't think what we do as politicians will be significantly altered if unions are 50%, if they're 30%, if they're 18% of the party decision-making process. I think what's more important is where our focus is, and going back to what I said in the speech about where our values lie, what we do and how we assess the position that we take around legislation or policy decisions is much more important.
Second last question.
Having been a former Secretary of the Labor Council, in a tradition that goes back to Jim Kenney, out of that experience, what do you think that's brought to you to become the next Premier?
Well, I actually think I'm very fortunate to have had the life experiences that I've had, to have worked on building sites at 16. I worked on the Parliament when it was actually, when the annex was built out the back, so I've sat around in dusty sheds or on a brick in a building site talking to migrants about their aspirations for their kids, and had that real opportunity. Yes, I was a union official, and yes, I've led the Labor Council or unions in New South Wales, but that gave me a lot of opportunities to sit with business leaders and CEOs as well, to see firsthand what it is that the challenges are for them. I wasn't one of these union officials that went out there and encouraged people to go on strike and all those sorts of things. I was fortunate that I started in a union that was very much conscious of the fact that to have good jobs, you've got to have a viable business. So my early years, I looked after electricians who worked for electrical contractors. So I got it very early in the piece that you need a good business and a good business model to have good, secure jobs. So it was. I took the view that I had a responsibility to, at times, help the employer get what they needed to keep those people employed in jobs. Having been Secretary of Unions New South Wales, the Labor Council, I did sit at a lot of times with politicians, I sat with business leaders, talking about a whole range of issues, and I think it opened my eyes more so than I think for a lot of other people, because I talked to small business operators, I talked to CEOs of multinational organisations about the challenges they had, the sorts of things that they need and the expectations. The other thing is, it gave me the opportunity to build relationships with people and an understanding of how important relationships are and respect for an alternate viewpoint, something that I think is absolutely critical. To not believe that you've got all the answers, to not believe that you're the font of all knowledge, to be prepared to be open, to be convinced, and prepared to change your mind sometimes. And I think all of those things occurred to me, or I was exposed to those because of the life and work experiences that I've had.
Final question, as you know, it's a year to the next election. You've had one good result in a by-election. What are you likely to be doing now, from now on to the next 12 months? Much the same thing, or some surprises? Or
Jared, it'll be more of the same. We've been doing a lot of hard work, and opposition is, I think, very tough, and I didn't underestimate how tough the job would be. But we've spent 3 years out there talking to CEOs, academics and other people who've got ideas about the sorts of things that we should be putting into our policies. We're getting to the pointy end now where we're starting to develop those policies and refine those, and we'll start to roll them out progressively over the next 12 months. The other thing we'll continue to do is highlight the inadequacies of the government, but we'll be also talking about some of the positive things that we want to do. We are without a doubt up against it at the next election. There is no question about that. But I take the view that I've got a responsibility to go into the next election with a view to doing everything I can to win, despite the fact that we are underdogs, and that is a huge ask. I often use the analogy with people that it's a bit like a grand final. Two teams go in, one will go in as the underdog, and there's no question that's us, but I've never seen underdogs go into a grand final and not play to win. And I think we owe it to Labor Party members, Labor Party supporters, and people who've said that they're prepared to vote for us to actually take that attitude going forward. So it'll be more hard work, it'll be day after day hard grind. Policy development, releasing policies in a timely fashion to give people the opportunity to look at what we've done over the last 3.5, 4 years when it comes to policy development. The one thing I don't want to do is, given the opportunity to become Premier and get your feet under the desk, I don't want to use the first 18 months for more reviews, inquiries and committees. I think that's what opposition's about. Opposition's about actually doing the work, doing the inquiries, coming up with the policies, working out what you want to do, and when you get there, getting the bureaucracy in and saying, right, these are the things that we want to implement, and I want you to start thinking about how you implement them.
Many thanks. Many thanks to John Robinson for a thoughtful presentation tonight. He's an unusual politician. There are not many politicians who worked on Parliament House and then worked in Parliament House. So if the lights go out, at least you know who to blame. Mr. Robinson. Without question, the Labor Party in New South Wales has always been a hugely important influence. It's a privilege for us to have the Leader of the Opposition, but also the Leader of the Labor Party here, talking to us tonight about what he's done over the past 3 years and where he's looking to take Labor in New South Wales and to some extent nationally over the next 12 months and beyond. So we'll have you back again, no doubt, but for tonight, well done and thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.